Happy Juneteenth, y'all. Hooray, hurrah, once again, the smartest man in the world, Proofcast, takes to the ether, this time from the salubrious confines of the Porpoise of Fruititude, located right here, underneath the glowing blue ball. The ball that controls my mind and all of our destiny. Once again, we join hands and join hearts and try to find some solace in each other's company in this burning centroid of murder that is planet Earth. And yes, look at this week. Oh my God, Juneteenth? Putin got the sads? Is anything better than when Putin's sad? Oh yeah, only one thing. When Orange 45 cries. Oh, I pressed the wrong button. How unlike me. Normally, I'm so on the tech. You know, despite what I look like in my glasses, I wasn't in the AV department when I was at grade school. So you can drop that notion right now. Did I start the song again? I probably did. Anyway, hooray. I'm Greg, me amo Gregorio. Jennifer's just off to here. She's in the air shaft that leads to this gigantic, commodious room here. I really can't show you all of it, but it's more like a cathedral or the deck of an aircraft carrier than but a humble home. As you know, Lower California is riddled with subterranean caverns and all sorts of medieval architecture. The history of this of the white people of Southern California goes back days, even weeks. And we found a burrow here that's kind of like a hobbit one. It's been to the side of a hill here in Los Angeles, and was once known as the Truman Capote Reconstruction Project here in West Hollywood, but it got shit canned so that they could work on the subway from now until the end of time. And by the way, if you come to LA, we have a giant, giant construction site where the subway's going to go. And it is so cool. It's like a dirt museum. I mean, if you really wanted to see what was underneath the streets of LA, you could just walk down Wilshire Boulevard and see it exhumed. Most cities don't do you that favor. Boston, I don't know if we have any Boston people in. And if we do, I'll go slow. If we have any Boston people in, the big dig in Boston, unbelievable. That took, what, 700 years? And nothing really happened at the end of it. You were like, oh, it's still Boston. Oh, I haven't turned the fucking music off. I turned it back on and then I turned it off. And all those great jokes drowned out. Anyways, here we are, and it's a joyful week because so much has changed and so much is different. And it's Paul McCartney's birthday. And I just wanted to say happy birthday to Paul McCartney. I don't know him, but I did meet him. And I've told the story way too many times. But it's kind of probably worth telling a little of it again because it's so good. I was invited to a party because my friend Neil Malarkey. By the way, Neil Malarkey told me that he thought his name was kooky. And I'm like, my name? He goes like, you know, my name's Malarkey. Like, you know, Malarkey. And I'm like, my name's Proops. I'm one R away from danger at all times. And I grew up with this. So I just, like, your name's kooky? No. It would be like if my name was, like, Greg Conviviality. It's just not that funny, really. Whereas Proops, oh my God, what an infinite variety of scatological humor you could be derived from that joke. So we went to this party for Wayne's World 2. That'll give you an idea of what year it was. In fact, it'll give you an exact idea of what year it was. We were at a Wayne's World 2 party, and we went to see Wayne's World 2, and then we went to the Hard Rock in London. And as you know, Paul McCartney, noted vegetarian. And at the time, Linda was there as well. And Linda sold vegetarian pies, frozen vegetarian pies, in every supermarket in England. So you'd go to this supermarket, and in the frozen section would be a picture of Linda McCartney, and it would say, like, delicious vegetarian pie or whatever. What's the line from Ab Fab? You know you are what you eat, right? Says Adina, and her daughter Safi goes, then you're a large vegetarian tart. I love scoring the first laugh of the evening with a joke written in the 90s by Jennifer Saunders. So, she was there, and she was really, really lovely. And she had that, you know, that awesome sort of lesbian tennis player mullet thing going on that all of Wings had. And so Paul was there because it was a benefit for a charity he did for Liverpool, and or as they would say, Liverpool. And I was there with all the comedy short players. So Richard Vaunch, who's the keyboard player on Whose Line and one of my best friends in the entire world, is a huge Beatles fan. Not just a Beatles fan, but like a Beatles fan. One of those ones, right? Like my cousin Donnie, kind of. I have two people in my life that are... Jennifer's totally stones, right? Like, she likes the Beatles. They're good-looking and funny, but... She's more of a Stones person. I like them both. And if I ever had to decide, I would choose by staking a small child to a hill and seeing if they lived or not. So I'm in the room, we're having hamburgers. The smell of hamburgers is everywhere. And there's Chrissy Hynde, and she's a noted vegetarian. And so there's nothing but celebrity vegetarians there, and just cheeseburgers flying around the room, which I thought was fantastic. And sort of like going to a hot dog stand, and in any case, Paul Merton is talking to Paul McCartney, and Paul Merton's a famous comedian. Not so famous then, but famous enough. And I see them rabbiting away, right? Like, and I go, Richard, this is our chance. And I grab Richard and we run over to Paul McCartney. And we snoodle into the, when you snoodle into the conversation, like, here's me coming into the Paul, you're Paul McCartney. And this is what you see. More like this in those days, right? That's so funny and true, what you just said. Everything you say is so funny and true, like all that great music. So, oh my God, the poetry. Yeah, like Jerry Lewis. Oh my God, the Beatles. So he goes, oh, you to me. Oh, mate, well done with the jokes and the improv and whatnot. Turns to Richard and he goes, and you, mate, with the guitar and the piano, making it up off the top. Bloody marvelous, mate, says Paul McCartney to Richard. And Richard goes, excuse me for a minute, I have to go. So we talked to Paul for a few more minutes, not about him, but about us and this and that. Obviously, he gets stoned and watches Who's Line, or did in the 90s. So, now the cue comes to fuck off, because there's a celebrity cue that goes off when you meet a really famous celebrity. It's nothing they say or do, just the air around you turns kind of bright orange. And everything, there's a dip in this in the cosine of the earth, right? Whatever's oscillating goes for a second, and you're like, gotta go. So we split. Richard's in the corner with a beer like this. I swear to you, at the Hard Rock, in the corner with a beer, sulking. Like, sulking over his beer. We've just met Paul McCartney, and Paul McCartney told him he was bloody marvelous. And I go, Richard, would you like to explain what the fuck that was about? And he goes, how'd you tell someone who's influenced your life since you were 6 years old that they've been a big influence? And I went, you don't. He knows. He's Paul fucking McCartney. Do you think everyone that's ever met him since 1967 has said the same fucking thing to him? Why don't you be the one who doesn't? Like, why don't you be the one who goes, ta ever so? Yeah, I enjoy playing a bit of guitar myself. Ha ha! But no. So that's my Paul McCartney story. So Jennifer sadly wasn't there on the night. I think she's in America. Another friend took the picture. And Paul McCartney, I got a picture of Paul McCartney on a really shitty camera that I had. That I think Whose Line might have given us, or I won on Jeopardy or something. I'm not kidding. That's another story. Anyway, I line up with Paul McCartney, and I'm wearing a suit and tie. Thank God I couldn't remember on the night, and she showed me the picture the other day. I'm in a suit with a vintage tie because it's old Greg and young Greg. And Paul McCartney and I are fucking standing next to each other and smiling and shit. And he looks so cute. It's like 1991. And I have one eye closed. So my picture with Paul McCartney is this. I look like I'm a fountain and someone threw a duck into me and it's been clogged up and no one's fucking dealt with it and everyone's angry and why is it still there and why doesn't someone pull the duck out? And like, it just suckitudinal, dickitudinal. Then we were looking through our celebrity pictures the other day, and because I did a show with Tom Jones. It was Tom Jones' birthday last week. He's 80. And everybody's birthday, right? The Beatles, Tom Jones. And he was hilarious, right? So I did a show called Viva Cabaret. And they had different acts. So in front of me, I was there to do stand-up. In front of me, before I came on, was a dude who smashed fruit. I swear to you, like Gallagher. So and this is England in the 90s. So no stagehands swept that stage clean. Nobody did shit. They moved the table. And I walked into a field of watermelon. I skated like Hans Brinker onto the set and fucking made it to the mic and shit. And so we had rehearsal on the day. Tom Jones shows up with his son. And the son was the one who redirected his career. This is the Kiss era, right? He had just done Kiss, and he was just back, right? Like, back. Like, now, he wasn't just relegated to Vegas or whatever. He was playing... God, he played the Circle Star in San Carlos. That's how long ago it was. He played the Circle Star in San Carlos, which was, you may laugh, it was a little cabaret in San Carlos, a circular theater, ergo its name. And everyone played there. It was really hokey. It had the worst food in the world. The ambiance outside was like going to a patio party at the Brady Bunch's house. It had those horrible bricks in the lobby, the little you know, manufactured bricks. It was just terrible. The snack bar was hot dogs and Cokes. And Frank Sinatra played there, and Ella Fitzgerald played there, and I saw Tower of Power there, I saw Cheech and Chong there, I saw the Mills Brothers there. How old are you, Greg? Wait. The Mills Brothers. I saw the Step Brothers. I saw Patti Page. I was waltzing with my darling, right? And when I saw Patti Page, she did. How much is that doggy in the window? And all the boys in the band went, arf, arf, like that, I swear, on every single chorus. The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? Arf, arf. I do hope that we were grown. I wasn't grown, but very amusing to watch acts from the previous generation when you're like, you want to say to people older than you, this was popular. But remember, Dinah Shore might have had the biggest singing career of any singer in this country up till, I don't know, like Beyonce. Like, Dinah Shore was giant. And I know you're like, who's Dinah Shore? Well, her name rhymes with dinosaur, so she disappeared when the comet hit the Earth. She was lovely. Anyway, Ella Fitzgerald I saw there in 74. And I've told this one, but who cares? We're having fun. Not only did she sing a lot of jazz and shit, and I mean, like, you know, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that. And because she's Ella, she'd go, like, unbelievable, right? She could blow, as they say in jazz. And then, because it was 1973 or 74, I was a kid, my parents took me. She goes, now I'd like to do one for you that you're probably familiar with. And she goes, I swear to God, boo-doo-doo-doo. And sings the song from Sanford and Son. There's no words. What a booty booty ball, did a hoop dip dude and whip beep squeeb. And then, come on, Sanford, right? It was fucking boss. Because I was like, we watched Sanford and Son like everyone did. And she just decided to put it in the act and scat the theme. I thought I'd made it up. And a jazz cat, when I told the story years ago, confirmed it and sent me a recording of it. And I was like, no. And it, yeah. Squeedum, hoodip, peedum, beedum, squeedum, boo. It was great. And then she did a saxophone duel with Eddie Lockjaw Davis. By the way, Count Basie was the band accompanying her. I saw the Count, right? And he wore a little sailor hat, right? Like he was going to take off on a yacht. And he had a suit on. And the band would be thrashing, right? They'd be like, bah! And he'd go, dink. We play one little note, man, and then the band. It was a swing band, right? And a lot of these cats had been with him. Oh golly, this is the 70s, so he'd been a band since the 20s, and Eddie Davis played in his band, who's a superb saxophonist, as we say. And I like flautist and saxophonist. I'm a comediast because it's, as my friend Dana Gould would say, Greg, you are so comedy adjacent. It's like you're in comedy. Eddie Davis gets off the stand and comes down onto the stage. And when I say the stage, the Circle Star Theater, if I could move this fucking camera... If I could turn back time, if I could find a way. By the way, Cher was on the Nicole Wallace show the other day, and I was just like, why? It's so great, though. We watched an interview. I'm coming back to the Sanford and Son story. I haven't forgotten. We watched a Cher-Hillary Clinton interview during the election, and Hillary Clinton, who's had to go head-to-head with, like, leaders of Kazakhstan and whatnot, people who are known for boiling people in oil, and the world leaders that Hillary Clinton had to deal with, all the shit she's been through. And Cher was so fucking full cap lock awesome. Like, Cher doesn't, like, do anything by half. Cher's like, everything's, you know, like, it's full tilt boogie. That Hillary, you could tell, was like this. That's great, Cher. You know, like, she was excited to talk to her, but she was also like, I didn't realize this was going to come, like, with wind machine intensity. I don't, you know, have you ever seen people do when they're pretending to jump school, when they're going to jump out of a plane with a parachute? What do they call it? Skyjacking? And, You leap out, and but you're not actually doing it. There's just a giant fan below you that's keeping you in the air. That's what Cher's energy was like. So you were just sort of suspended on the wind of her energy. I saw Cher, too, but not at the Circle Star. I saw her on the boardwalk in Atlantic City at this big theater with Drew Carey, Colin Mochrie, and Brad Sherwood. And it was such a gay, gay day. We went and had Italian food first. Then we went to see Cher. And they were playing disco music. And the whole crowd was Jersey Girls and Mooks from Philly, right? So there was so many girls with giant hair and then so many Mooks from Philly. And everyone was dancing when we got up. And it was, I can't remember what they were playing. And Drew goes, let's dance. So we all get up. We're fucking dancing and shit. And then Cher comes out in a ringmaster's costume with the tights, you know. And she goes, look out, Britney and Christina. Look out, bitches, there's a new sheriff in town or whatever. And then she goes, it's the sheriff's show on earth. Because she's wearing a ringmaster outfit. And she splits. And Brad turns to us and goes, it's the greatest chair on earth. How did you, in your own intro? So there was a part from the Lion King, giant elephants came out. There was a part from Cirque du Soleil. People rappelled on those red ropes down the thing and twirled around. There was triple screens. When Sonny was mentioned in the show, he was only on video and kind of a montage, right? Like, sort of like, the beat goes on and like, oh, remember him? And then a giant 30-minute version of Do You Believe in Love to close the show with several wig changes. It was great. And her on the giant screen, super druggy, like, ten minutes of that. Then she appears on stage with, like, that weird white beaded Cleopatra wig. It's fucking great. Oh, and she did If I Could Turn Back Time. So she wore the outfit from the video, right? The one that was like, oh my God, am I actually seeing what I think I'm seeing? Like, am I seeing New Year's Day? I feel like I'm if I can put this delicately, working at the post office, because I think I can see the envelope. I mean, I can decidedly see the postcode. And she was 60 years old, that show, by the way. That was some 14 years ago. So the show's over, and we leave. And Drew goes, meh. Colin and I are, by the way, a flutter. Colin and I are literally slapping ourselves like this. Oh, my God, it was so good. What part did you like the most? And then Brad's like, why didn't she do a medley of Dark Lady and Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves? Why didn't she just sing each song? You know, that's what we were bitching about. She did a medley of Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves. And does anyone know who Cher is before I go any further? I seem to have broached into a subject here that people seem to have. Drew goes, right? Because he's a contrarian. Drew's a partial libertarian. That'll give you an idea of where he's coming from, right? So he goes, Bon Jovi was better. And I went, I fucking put the brakes on that shit. Apples and fucking oranges. I go, Drew, Bon Jovi's one thing, which as Joe Campiola used to say, Dexter Madison, a comedian from San Francisco, Bon Jovi means in French, good Jovi. I go, Bon Jovi's one matter. I go, Cher's 60 years old. And she got up there wearing that Cucciatore outfit. And I go, when you're 60, I want to see that. And he... This is what I love about Atlantic City. Everybody's from Philly. Or they're from Jersey. And fights break out over, like, how much you like the food. Like, people will stick you with a knife because... So we're sitting at the table, and a guy comes over and says, hey, yous guys, and they always do in Jersey, yous guys. Hey, yous guys, I find it amusing. People from Jersey are like, what? That's how we talk. I'm like, look, I'm from California, but I don't come on and go, hey, stunning combo. Actually, I do. He goes, hey, his guys. Because his guys is real funny. And we were sitting with a road manager whose name was Drew, a different Drew. And he goes, yeah, I thought you were talking to me. And the guy goes, hey, fuck you. And then he goes, no, hey, fuck you. And the next thing you know, they're like squaring, right? They're squaring. And I go, hey, gentlemen, certainly this evening's bon ami might be contingent upon how much we respect one another's personal areas. My goodness, I think we're all in agreement here that we guys are very funny. I wonder, might you settle your differences in the age-old way of drinking? And so they both fucking... And when he's like, anyways, I wanted to tell you guys you were funny. And he leaves, he looks at Drew, you fucking... And I'm like, was there any reason for this aggression? I mean, it reminded me of, in the collective memory of man, a lot of us go back 3.5 million years to Mother Africa and Olduvai Gorge, where the first hominids made their living and and tried to scratch out an existence against the backdrop of gigantic carnivores. And at the watering hole, I can imagine you'd be there at the watering hole, and I don't know what to do. You know, I'm working on a cave painting. I'm a little conflicted about it. I've been chasing this herd for weeks. I've only managed to catch two of the gazelles. And the Jersey prototype Neanderthal comes up and goes, what the fuck are you looking at? And you're like, look, I just wanted to get some fire and go back. And he's like, no, fuck you. And then, really? We're going to have homicide? I swear to you that Cain was... from Jersey, the one who killed Abel. I'm going to orient you to where I'm coming from on this. We just moved from 3.5 million years ago to the Bible. Because I love fiction. Is someone in a bus? That sounded so awesome. So Eddie Davis comes off the stand from Count Basie's orchestra. And he on the stage at the Circle Star, the stage was like this, right? There was two entrances and two star entrances up the top where the dressing rooms were. So the star and all of the people who played in the band had to come down this gigantic aisle and traverse the entirety of the theater to get to the stage. Then they would ascend. The band was on one side of the circle. The other performing area was on the other side of the circle. Then Ella would start singing, and after about a couple minutes, they'd start the stage. And the stage had a motor in it from 1938. It was like a motor, like it was in the Titanic or something, because it would go chunk, clunk, bonk, and kick into gear, and then pow. And the stage would start to turn, and then the performer would, like a lazy Susan, right? So now they're singing like this to you. So pretend you're watching Tower of Power. You're still a young man, baby, right? Like you're watching them spin like syrup on a breakfast table, right? Just woo, and slowly. So every few minutes they get to where you are, and you got this, right? It's the right time and the right place. Though your face is lovely, it's not the right face. Right? Like, all you get is this thing as they brushed by you. Watching comedy there. Wow. I saw Cheech and Chong. But then they did it right. So Eddie Davis comes off the stand with his sax off. And him and Ella Fitzgerald just pitch up, right? Like duelists. She's got her microphone in her hand. He stands there in front of him, like, and he goes like, and she goes, I swear to God, that went on for 10 minutes. And I was like, I don't think I'd ever seen anything like that before at 13. I was like, this is awesome that you're just going to vocalize. And yeah, I also saw Pearl Bailey there. And Pearl Bailey was a performer who did stage, screen, she was a recording star. She's in some brilliant movies. She's brilliant in a movie called The Landlord from 1969. She's brilliant in, what's the one I'm trying to think of from the 50s? That there's one with Nat King Cole, isn't she in that one as well? The one about W.C. Handy? In any case, she's a remarkable star. And my mother loved Pearl Bailey. And Richard Nixon loved Pearl Bailey. Don't ask. Richard Nixon loved Pearl Bailey. And she would sing, but she had this offhand delivery, right? She'd go like, oh, honey, I'm just trying to make it. Like, she had this hilarious, and she'd go, She says at the top of the show, she comes out and she goes, Richard Nixon had had her to the White House and given her an honorary title and meted and greeted her. And there was a big photo op and it was on TV and shit. And he made her the ambassador of love. Okay? The ambassador of love. So at the top of the show, she goes, I've been to the White House, honey. And everybody went, yay. And she goes, I'm going to be telling a lot of stories tonight. And just to keep things simple and to shorten things up, whenever I say the house, I mean the White House. So later in the show, she does a couple numbers, and then she's like, so anyway, I was at the house, and the place fucking comes to pieces, right? She did it about 100 times. It was great. St. Louis Blues. If you ever watch her, she's fantastic. And her husband was Louis Belson, who I think just swirled off a couple years ago. Great jazz drummer. He was the band leader for her show. And she sang a, everybody's talking at me. She did that one. And then when she did the skipping over the ocean like a stone part, she'd pretend she was old and creaky and go like that. Oh, yeah. There was every dancing. She danced. It was great. Yeah. The ambassador of love. Mind you, Nixon had Elvis at the White House. And Elvis has, it was later revealed, of course, that Elvis was, as usual, completely blitzkrieged on a dazzling variety of downers, which was his tipple, right? Elvis liked opioids the way the Sackler family likes opening museums, right? Like, they really loved his opioids. He would send all of his minions to the 24-hour pharmacies, of which there were many in Memphis in those days, to pick up every derivative of heroin you could, like Dilaudid and whatnot. So, I'm sure you've seen the picture of Nixon and Elvis. Elvis is wearing one of his great outfits, right? With a collar and a scarf and a jumpsuit and a gigantic belt and enormous tinted shades and giant hair. And Richard Nixon's wearing his usual outfit, the carapace of evil. And they're shaking hands, and there's always the caption says, when the president met the king. So in the Nixon Museum, and yes, I've been in the Nixon Museum. It's in Yorba Linda or Whittier, somewhere around there, yeah. In Orange County. By the way, Nixon was poor. There's not that many presidents that were poor. Joe Biden, reasonably poor. Hillary, reasonably poor. Bill, poor. JFK, ooh, not so poor. The Bushes, Reagan, I think, grew up poor. Funny how the conservative ones, when they grow up poor and then become conservative, are like extra special evil. And then there's your rich kids. Well, never mind. In any case, Nixon, at the museum, before he passed, he was unbelievably loquacious. And even in his Roman banishment, which, by the way, banishing someone to a mansion in San Clemente is not exactly like putting them on an island where they have to eat their own mattress until they die, which is something the Romans did. San Clemente is beautiful, right wing as fuck, but great food and great Mexican food. And his house was on the beach. I mean, he had beachfront property. By the way, there's a famous picture of Nixon in a full suit and tie with dress shoes walking down the beach in his dress shoes. And that's him in isolation, right? Because Nixon was never casual, right? So we're getting out with this. In his library, before he died, not only did he do two epically long fucking specials with David Frost, where he exonerated himself from all of his wrongdoing. Mind you, his attorney general went to jail. His chief of staff, I think, went to jail. One of his hatchet men went to jail. Ehrlichman, Haldeman, Coulson, Liddy, the other fucking goon, the one who was the Roger Stone. Oh, Roger Stone was there, by the way, for this. He was a young guy then. That's how evil they are.
So was Manafort.
Manafort was there, too. He was a kid. God, when you remember when you were just a young Nazi? Reporting for duty, sir! In any case, he recorded a bunch of answers to questions. Random questions. So you go to this lectern in the Nixon Museum, and there's a field of screens. And you on the lectern, there's topics. And so you press one, and one of them was Elvis Presley. So Jennifer and I pressed the Elvis Presley button. So the screen lights up, and there's Nixon. He's alive again. And he goes, well, Trisha was a huge fan of Elvis, and I was very excited when he came to the White House. Of course, later we found out he was on drugs, but you know what? It was okay, because all of those drugs were perfectly legal. They were prescription drugs.
We almost got thrown out for laughing.
We laughed so hard that the security was like... I went there once by myself, and which is probably better so you don't laugh too much. And Nixon had been there. He was alive then. And he had been there for a baseball thing. Nixon, I don't know if you know this, along with David Eisenhower, who married Tricia, who was Dwight Eisenhower, the president's son. That's right. Nixon, who was vice president to Eisenhower for 8 years, daughter married his president's son. Anybody feeling creepy? I know I do. So, was a huge baseball fan. And Nixon used to sit around and, like, make up, like, all-time teams and shit with David. They'd, like, sit around and go, like, well, Willie Mays in center. No, 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 you know, Ty Cobb and right. Like, I swear to you. And at this event, Willie wasn't there, but Hank Aaron had been there and Ernie Banks, whatnot. Because there was a program. I bought it, of course. And so I get to the counter, and this is one of my favorite things to do, especially when you go to a right-wing haven or shrine. I'm a white guy, and I look the way I do, so I get away with it. Even though clearly I'm effeminate, they're somehow willing to accept me. I walk up to the counter and I go, I understand the president was here the other day. That must have been amazing. And the woman behind the counter goes, oh my God, it was so great. Right? This is Nixon in disgrace. I swear to you, when you go to the fucking Orange 45 library in 7 years, right? Where they'll have an animatronic of him out in front, right? You know, I said they were... the Mexicans are rapists or whatever, like, you know, whatever the right, it'll be like Chuck E. Cheese, right? They'll be like, Don Jr. will be there sweating and you'll push a button and like white powder will come out of his nose or whatever. And then you're supposed to, you're like horchata, you know, whatever Orange 45's horrible legacy are going to be. I'm sure there'll be one of those claws where you put the money in and try to pick stuff up because that's the most rip-off game of all time. No one's ever won it. No one's ever gotten anything. The closest you've gotten is part of a thing got caught on one of the claws and then it dropped and then it didn't go in the fucking hole. And that was after you'd spent $30.
Erased the Zamboni.
Yeah, the Zamboni, right? The Zamboni that erases history. That's like history is written on an ice rink and this Zamboni just rolls over it and just ices it over every few minutes. No, there was no insurrection. No, we didn't try to hang Mike Pence. It was a tourist party. It got out of hand. At his museum, there's not going to be any answering of questions, I assure you of that. God, they're not going to give him one, are they? Of course they will. When you go to it in 7 years, when you go to the Orange 45 Museum, I want you to walk up to the person at the counter and go, If only we could have been there for January 6th, right? And the person's going to go, oh, fuck yeah. And they're going to go, I still have a legacy Facebook page. It's called Proud Führers. We were a group of people. We couldn't get dates and no one liked us. But we knew what we were angry about. What were you angry about? Oh, the Negro. They're pushing us out of history. And I've always asked the question, and I think it bears repeating tonight. When will white men be heard from? When will we have our voice fully explored in the media and in history? How come it's always from the other point of view? I love criticizing history that includes facts. That's the best part. You know, well, a slave boat came. Whoa, 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 whoa. What about my feelings here? You just said slave boat. But it's true. I know how I feel. It's sort of like the Meghan McCain school of history where, because right wingers never have anything to support anything they're talking about because everything they say is complete and utter foo-faw and sloosh and faw-faw and hoop-de-doo and balderdash and tommy-trot. So they always refer to, I remember watching Elizabeth Hasselbeck cry on The View once because someone brought up a woman's right to choose and she started crying because evidently pretend unborn babies make her sad. And she started bawling and that was the end of the argument, right? Everyone's like, we're trying to talk about women's health here. We're trying to talk about a woman's right to choose, the autonomy, the agency of women to own their own body, blah, blah, blah. And she just goes, I know. All I know is how I feel. And you're like, you know what? How you feel is shitty. And you're making the rest of us feel shitty too. All the anger and boiling resentment and fake grievance that people are bringing to the table makes everyone feel shitty. And I think that's why they do it. they all have an emotional hate goiter that lives under their armpit, right? And it's just crying out all the time, we don't need no health care. We don't need no gun control. Babies don't need to eat. Where's more helicopters? And they have to feed the emotional hate goiter because they're incapable of feeling anything. Why would you fight this right now? Why would you fight everyone getting money, the economy approving, everyone getting vaccinated, and things sort of turning around and being sort of like they were before when we used to have fun? Why? What on earth would compel you at this point to dig in your heels and go, I don't want that. If there's going to be black people telling me what to do, I'm going home. The one thing I'm not looking forward to when the world returns to normal is being in airports and seeing dudes with reflective mirror shades and gigantic guns on their backs, wearing camo and carrying duffel bags. That never makes me feel comfortable. They bowl around the airports of the Midwest like they own the goddamn place. Like if you acted that way in any public place, someone would think you were insane. But white guys have granted themselves citizenship of every artery of America. And so any space they're in is a space they own. And when they have firearms, it makes them feel extra special good because they know what firearms do to a crowd. We're having a really good time here tonight. If we were all in a comedy club together and we were having fun at the show and we were drinking and we went outside and smoked dope and then we were listening to jokes and then while I was on stage, pulled out a gun and fucking loaded it and started going like this with it, that would really take the fun right out of the evening. Yet people who carry guns don't see it that way. Somehow, whatever, however their corpuscular arteries flow, there's a restricted blood flow until firearms are introduced. Then all of a sudden they can breathe again. It's exactly the opposite of human behavior, and it's completely counterintuitive to anything that anyone would... Well, let me put it this way. There's going to be people in the next few years who are going to talk about how great he was. They really are. And it'll be like the people who apologize for Hitler until the day they die. They're always going to be like, I knew... And I always want to say to them, you loved him, eh? Well, what was the moment that made you love him the most? Was it when he made fun of the handicapped reporter and went... At that moment, did you go, oh my God... That was like seeing a fawn on my front lawn before the sun came up. That was like seeing a flock of butterflies drying in a tree. That was like receiving kisses from a child. Was it when he came down the escalator and went, Mexican rapist. At that moment, did you go like, oh my God, finally. I'm imbued with an all-encompassing glow. Like a pink and perfect perfection has suffused every cell of my body. Oh my God, this is like receiving kisses from a child. Wait a minute, is that a fruit tart floating through the air before me? What magic is this that this man possesses? I mean, Joe Biden might not be a lot of things, young, but what's up? Oh, right, there's a baby bunny in front of the White House today, by the way. You may remember during 45, there was nothing, they would always find vermin running around. There'd be a rat, literally a rat running around the White House, and you're like, how did Mark Meadows get out? And then today there was literally a baby bunny in front of the White House. I don't know if anyone put it there or the baby bunny just came of its own, but it's a great PR move either way. As we would say in ancient Rome, that is a great augury. You'd pay the priest to let the bunny loose. And now... I'd like to predict how the next 4 years of my reign will go. Bunnies are released. Everyone, oh, and you're like, well, that's all I have to say for today, folks. So it was awesome this week because we got a lot done. We're creeping. What time is it? We probably should start. Well, I don't know if we need to start. Biden went to the G7, and they were in England. And Boris Johnson, who pretends to be prime minister on a TV show, called the Daily Mail. He floofs his hair downwards and he assumes a stance like this at all times so that he can reinforce to you that he's physically repulsive and therefore get away with everything. In any case, he said that Joe Biden was a breath of fresh air. And I don't know if you are familiar with how the English relate things to one another, but understatement is a real big part of their case, right? Like an English person would never go, oh my God, I hate that fucking person. They're the worst person on earth. They go, ah, yes. So are you going to be able to spend all of your time with us? They back everything in. They back it all in, right? They'll be like, oh, I see you've brought your new outfit. Well done. You know, they will put you down, baby. So Boris Johnson, they said, what's it like having Biden? Anyway, oh, it's like a breath of fresh air. And that means the other guy made me sick beyond all measure. That every cell in my body was going to explode from repulsion. That it was like being with a low-rent gangster from Queens who took orders from other low-rent dudes. Abuser of women and abuser of people comes off him in waves. Comes off him in waves. And I think having Joe there... And you know how Joe is. It's like he's a dad from the 50s or whatever. What did he say the other day? He was mad with Caitlin Collins for a minute, and he went, I want to apologize to the reporter. I was kind of a wise guy. Boy, you certainly were. You were also a jackanape.
What about Macron?
Macron was holding him like Macron wanted to be inside him. Macron had his hands, two hands on one hand, and was like, Joe... And then remember what he said? They said, what's it like having Joe Biden there? And he went, finally, a leader who is a member of the club. And if you know anything about French people, they don't come out with warmth right away. You know, French people test you to see if you're cool. That's why people think they're rude. Because if you're in Paris and you go, hey, can I get a hamburger, Frenchie? There's no, that's it. It's over. They'll literally turn you into a butter pat and spread the sidewalk with you. And it doesn't take much because a waiter in France can go like this. When you say something shit, they'll literally go like this. And that's it. You'll never reach them again. You might as well move to Antarctica and send a fucking carrier pigeon with an M&M in its mouth because it's never reaching. The message will not reach Garcia. So for Macron to say he's a member of the club. Also, you notice, except for Bojo, they're all reasonably sexy. We've got some sexy leaders going. But what it reminded me of was Paris, which I wanted to talk about ever so briefly since I've led myself down this Macron, Rue Macron, back to Paris again. I'm lucky enough to get to go there, and we play at the bookstore, which is a fantastic turn of events. The old comedy club we played at was in the Al-Qaeda district, and there was this fantastic hubba bubba shisha place upstairs called The Name of the Rose or something? It had a rose in its name, the hors d'oeuvre de rose or something. And it was a lot of angry men sort of smoking angrily at you. The club was called La Java, and it was a jazz club from the 20s, and it had two enormous staircases that described a half circle down into the room. The room had never been cleaned, and the bathroom was unisex. That meant you could do drugs in it, and they had cameras in there to watch you do them. And so we were all sharing one bathroom, and the soap was this terrible affair. It wasn't soap that came out of a thing you push. It wasn't a bar of soap, which England used to still have bars of soap, even up till a few years ago, bars of soap in public bathrooms. So you would pick up the bar of soap and be like, oh my God, why not just have a water ladle that we all drink out of, like in Christ's time? The one in Paris had not a bar of soap, a yellow cone like this, just the biggest fucking phallic, hideous cone. And you had to rub it like that to get the soap. And I remember just, I used the toilet, I was coming over to wash my hands, and I'm like, oh no. I really didn't think we were going to be making a movie tonight. This just got crazy. And fantastically, the man who ran the club, who was specious beyond all measure, and he wore a trench coat indoors, got up and said, look, it's not non-smoking night, but if you could just try to smoke less. One of the great things ever said at a nightclub before my show. And one time we were taking a cab there, Jennifer and I, and the woman driving the cab was a very small woman wearing a headscarf, and she had a big, gigantic personality, right? So
with her phone and
she had a little phone, and we passed the place we're supposed to go. We missed the turnoff where we had to turn somewhere, and so she goes, never mind, I'll deal with this. Sticks the phone in her headscarf like this, boonk, and fucking slams it in reverse. And we went down the narrowest street in Paris with the metal pylons on either side, the metal things they have in Paris. 50, 60 miles an hour. And Jennifer and I just turned to each other and went, you know, like, I love you. Bye.
I told her we were late.
Right. That's right. That was, it was your fault. Jennifer said, we're late. And she went, right. D'accord. Then we missed our turn. And so there was an enormous line of Parisian traffic behind us. And she stopped the cab and got out of it and went to the car behind us and made them back up. And then she got back in the cab. That fucking car backed up. She backed up and then she turned. Yeah, I was just like, you're the greatest driver I've ever seen in my life. I would be terrified. First of all, why are you driving in Paris? You know, like, take a cab. Yeah. So I think you can have some good times. But we've moved to a bookstore now. So I know what you're thinking. Greg, what you were talking about before, La Java, certainly it was a jazz bar and it had alcohol. And then there was another place on the Canal Saint-Martin that was a very famous. There was a movie made about it called, what was it called? Number 10, Key to... In any case, that place, the bartender spoke perfect English because he was a compulsive gambler and he would go to Vegas 2 or 3 times a year and blow all of his money.
Wasn't he friends with Dennis Hopper?
Mm. He was a reprobate. He was friends with Dennis Hopper. His name was Jam. Jam. And that place had glass walls. So during a comedy show, there'd be 300 people in the place. No windows open. Everyone smoking. By the end of the show, the walls were pouring water. And so I'm... Talk about a COVID super spreader. Are we changing that when we go back to normal? The idea that a club like that went and got a big... HVAC system and an infrared light. We're lucky we're not having to rub the conical phallus just to get some soap around here. Paris still has some of the toilets that are literally a circle that you walk into a booth and you're like, oh, this is it. Right? All of a sudden it's like, locks away, chaps! Bombs away! Try not to hit anything. So I was talking about Paris because he went to the G7 and then they went to Switzerland, and I don't know if you saw him, his little chat. You could tell that the old pooter from Russia was sad because he got up and lied extra special, sadly, after. Also, doesn't he look like a pit bull that's been sent through the atmosphere and probably reentered a little too quickly? There's a melty... He's one of those people who thinks, no, the injections look good. And because he's a dictator and he'll chop your head off like Idi Amin or whatever, everyone around him goes, no, you look good. You look good. And then he comes out. The Black Lives Matter movement is terrorist. Do not confuse me with the senator from Wisconsin. Yeah, and then Biden comes out, and he puts, what did someone say? Does this change your relationship with Putin? And he goes, all right, see you mugs on the other side. Like, he just flipped his shades on and fucking William Holden in Stalag 13. What does he say at the end of Stalag 13? He's going to, any of you guys ever see me on the street? Pretend you don't know me. Joe Biden just fucking... Shine on, you crazy Biden. Burr, 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 burr. He's hip, baby. He says man and joking. I love that one. Joking. And then not a joke. They're my other favorite one. Not a joke. I'm like, okay, you're president. We all got you. Hey, I'm acting like a wise guy. Hey, who's the Weisenheimer? Who's being a fink?
Look.
Yeah, right? He goes, look, we've been utzed. Right, suddenly he's in the Bowery Boys. Yeah, we've been utzed. awesome week. That happened. He went to Europe. He kicked ass. He got everybody to agree on a big tax on rich people, for real. He alleviated a bunch of student debt. They're moving right along on everything. 300 million people have at least one vaccination. Wow. Mm-hmm. We were all going to die in January. I don't know if you remember coming on, watching your TV. Here in Los Angeles, our mayor is a very nice man. He's a Jewish, Mexican, Italian. He speaks several languages. Mm-hmm. And his mien is like this. Hello, I'm Mayor Garcetti. Everyone's going to die. That's how he delivers the news, right? Yeah, was it one night in last May, in the middle of giving the casualty count, and the health, and you know, and the, they're signing behind him, and the health inspector's crying in the corner. There's an earthquake, and the camera didn't shake, but a guy runs on and says to him, "There's been an earthquake." And Mayor Garcetti lifts his head. I kept it on my phone because it's the greatest moment. "Well, there's just been a terrible earthquake in Bakersfield, and I don't see how much worse things can get." Thank you, mayor of a city with 10 million people. From Glendale to Huntington Beach, it's... From Santa Monica to the mountains, I don't see how it could get any worse. Good night, everybody. The city of angels? More like the city of people about to be fucking angels. What, are you kidding me? It was hilarious. So, in January, he came on telly and he says, if you can help it, just don't do anything. He goes, if you have to go outside, do. And we were like, what? And then now, what is it? Literally 6 months later, and our governor was on TV 2 days ago with at Universal Studios with the Minions and the trolls, with the hair and the robots from what fucking movie, Transformer, whatnot. And they had psychedelic bubbles everywhere, and music was fucking playing, and it was like you were on E. And he goes, "Wait, California's back." Oh, I don't know if you've heard our governor talk, but he talks like a coke dealer who's cheating you at 21. California's back. Then he gets in the roller coaster. "We're giving away cash prizes." They gave away cash prizes on the day. This city, this state, your state, you want it to be a, when you have a red legislature, you know, it can be a drag. When you have a blue legislature and a blue governor, this is what you got. This is him. It says here, get vaxxed and you have the chance to win a dream vacation. Get a ticket to Six Flags and you'll get $50. This is our governor. Our governor is looking at his phone like he's fucking coked up at a bus stop. "You'll get $50, he says. We're living in a giant game show here. And everything's open, right? So I went out yesterday. I went to the, you know, the marijuana place. I mean, the pharmacy and the supermarket and whatnot. I call it a supermarket. I live in Joe Biden's world. I took the station wagon down to the supermarket. First, I took it by Rick's to get the tires checked. And then when I went to the filling station, I said, "How about checking the oil, fella?" You guys are looking at me. What did Paul Mooney say? Like I'm from the planet Olda Taurus here. Then we went out. Oh, I had all these things. Oh, we still have time. Don't we? Yeah. Awesome. It's only 6, right? God, my eyesight. No wonder that picture came out like that with Paul McCartney. I must have been trying to focus on something that was 11 inches to the right of my right eye, because I must have gone like, "He's a real nowhere man." Oh, so I took a picture with Tom Jones. I never told you that part. And on the night, and he was really tan, and he just had a nose job, so he looked fucking great. And I look okay. I'm thin. But I'm not wearing a suit in that picture. I'm wearing a t-shirt of Lipsinka, the drag artist who goes by Lipsinka, who lip syncs. And the t-shirt says, "Fame can be poison." Yeah, I can't explain everything. I really can't. And then, of course, Kamala's big week. First of all, she had a banquet for all of the women in the Senate. And even some of the Republicans came, because we like to see when sisterhood's bigger than that terrible wall that the Republicans have built between us and reality. So Marsha Blackburn was there from Tennessee, and Capito was there, and Collins and Murkowski were there. And this is starting to sound like a college football. Collins and Murkowski were there on a cold, clear afternoon in Washington, D.C. Kamala Harris put forth an all-star team. What is his name, John Facenda? Early in the evening, she served cocktails. In the second quarter, rosé. But by the time dessert had come around, chairs had been upturned. Lisa Murkowski remembers. "All I remember is seeing Kamala swirling around me in a circle. I don't know who had eaten the last piece of ahi, but I was going to get that last cheese puff. It was the last fucking thing. Deedly, leedly, leedly, leedly. So they had a banquet. And what was the menu? Ahi? No. Mm-hmm. Ahi. Mm-hmm. And Kamala.
Mahi-mahi.
Kamala. Mahi-mahi. I love it. Right? Mahi-mahi. Not native to Washington, D.C. I was on a cruise with Lewis Black once. This is turning into a Cliff Richard song now. In the bouncy month of May, and Lewis Black and I scrubbed along. And we went on a comedy cruise with Lewis Black. And down to the Caribbean and back. We saw Montego. We saw St. John. But when we left there, we went to Virgin Islands, which is horrid. The part they take you to, and St. Martin, or we went to the French part. The Dutch part's called St. Martin, and the French part's called St. Martin. So, yeah, you be the judge. And still the controversy persists. The first day out on the cruise, we were on a gigantic vessel called the Bummer of the Seas. And we birthed out of Orlando, I think, mm-hmm. where they all do. There's a gigantic waste-making machine and COVID spreader down in Florida called the cruise ship industry, and we were taking part in that. And Vic Henley, the late Vic Henley, who swirled off into the heavens last year of the COVID, we believe, although it was never discovered, turned to me and Jennifer, and Vic was from Alabama, and he had an accent like Deputy Dog. So we're standing in this enormous security queue, and Jennifer's countenance is tightening into discomfiture. And Vic senses our unquiet and says, "Don't worry, they give y'all your own balcony, so you will have some fucking privacy." And that was what saved us. We had a balcony. On one side, a Scottish couple who were clearly in the last stages of emphysema. All they did was chain smoke cigarettes and cough and go, "Oh, fucking brilliant dinner." And the wife would go, "Oh, I brilliant." Right? And on the other side, two 80-year-old black women who talked about nothing but their medication. "Well, I'm supposed to take one before dinner, but I forgot, and so I took it after dinner." And then the other one will go, "Well, you could take it now, because we're just sitting here." And, "Well, I was going to, but I took it before." This was like a Homer, like that long every night, right? It was like listening to Homer spiel the Iliad, the two stories from either side. And all I thought was, I love them both, because I was perpetually smoking marijuana outside, and no one said a fucking word. Because no one was supposed to be outside smoking at all, no matter what. So if that was kind of a awesome. And one day I went to the cafeteria line or whatever. Oh, the banquet room or whatever. Which, by the way, the banquet room on the Bummer of the Seas had an enormous portrait of Leonardo da Vinci, Einstein, and Darwin, was it? Right? But it was wall to ceiling, and it looked like it had been drawn as a movie poster in the early 70s. So the art, the graphics were just shocking. And then why were those the geniuses that were chosen to... We're in a ship. And then the lounge where we did comedy had a complete Egyptian motif down to cats in the walls. And Ramesses and whatnot. And Ra... there's nothing funnier than performing in front of Amun-Ra. And at the buffet line, there's a guy wearing a chef's hat and an apron. And there's a sign in front of the fish, little white fish that, you know how they float in the tray. Are we still doing that? Are we still doing the trays? I think we are.
Oh, God, yeah.
And the tray with all the fish things in it. And it says, "Catch of the day." Now, we're 3 days into the Atlantic. We're 3 days into the Atlantic. We left from Florida. We've been sailing for 3 days on a boat that makes 24 knots an hour and really doesn't go any slower than that. So we're way out.
There's like nothing.
Right? So I say to him, "Chef," because I'm willing to play along. He hasn't cooked anything, you see. He's just wearing a chef's hat because there is no cooked food on a book, on a ship. They thaw whatever they did and they heat it and they nuke it. Anyway, I say, "Chef, what's the catch of the day? And he's like, it's catfish. And I'm like, we're in the middle of the Atlantic. This is not the catch of the day. This is the catch of a day. A day that preceded this day by some time. Because my family's from Mississippi, and catfish live in a pond behind my cousin George's house. They do not live in the middle of the Atlantic above St. Thomas. Later, when I was eating at the hamburger stand, I'm sure that story had a... The cruise ship. Mm-hmm. Mm. Oh, right. The first night, there was a storm, and the ship was so enormous. It was bigger than anything in World War II. The ship was so enormous, we were on in the restaurant, like on the 10th floor or something, and it was going like that, right? And we look out the window, and waves are going 8-10 stories up. So now it's time for comedy. And I go down to the Egyptian lounge, and we've all had a few drinks, and we're all scared shitless at this point. And Kathleen Madigan gets up, who's a genius, and she's smoking, and she's got a Budweiser, and she's shit-faced. And she's 5 feet tall, and she's standing in front of the microphone, and like a cartoon, she's going like this, and the microphone's going like that. My brother Mike is such a fucking moron. Every time I go, I'm from Missouri, right? Like, it was the greatest comedy night of my life. Just everyone was like, and then the captain comes on and is like, well, this is only going to last like, oh, he was Norwegian. And you go, I'm not kidding. Bing bong, hello, this is Captain Thorspaking. Here the bummer of the seas, I'm afraid of, I'm sorry for the rough sea, but it's only going to last another 7.5 hours. Like you are Captain Tor. So this week, yeah, Kamala had the banquet for the senators. And why is that important? Think about it. Do you remember Karen Pence having anyone in that wasn't a homophobic person who believed that we could reprogram gays? And then 2 weeks ago, Dougie and Kamala were dancing down the street at the Pride Parade in Washington, D.C. Little bit of a sea change, doesn't one think? You wouldn't know it by watching news on TV. If you watch the news on TV, they're like, well, one party tried to break into the Capitol and use violence to destroy things and possibly hang the vice president. The other party is exactly the same. We'll be right back. So for her to throw something like that, and she's a good cook, she cooked cheese puffs. And like, dude, I don't want to say that Bay Area, she's from Oakland. There's one thing we know in the Bay Area. When people get there, you stick a drink in their hand. And she's vice president, so she can't stick a joint in their mouth. But you give them stoner food immediately. Everyone hasn't eaten all day. They've come to your dinner party, but they haven't eaten since lunch. So they're starving. They're starving. And they want a cheese puff. And she made homemade cheese puffs. And two or three of the senators, including Republican ones, were like, oh my God, the cheese puffs. And like, these are senators of, you know, 10 million constituents, whatever, giant position, one of an elite group of 100 people that makes the most important policy in the whole free world. You know, the Roman Senate was always calling itself the greatest deliberative body in the history of mankind. I'm sure the Knesset feels that way, or the what's the Japanese Senate called? I'm just blanked on the name of it. Anyway, yeah, the cheese puffs are what get them. Amy Klobuchar, at one point, there's a photo of them, and they had cockies before, then they had rosé with the first course, then white wine, then I'm presuming we resume cockies and or dessert wines at dessert. And dessert was a...
Strawberry rhubarb.
Strawberry rhubarb, I love it. Amy Klobuchar's going like this in one picture, as if she was just meeting Paul McCartney. Try to imagine her hair on me. It makes it funnier. You know the Amy Klobuchar hair? I love that she goes to, I can't believe it's Donna Reed. That was for me and nobody. So, Kamala Harris, are things better than they were? Yeah. Are they going to be extra better? Is everyone going to get justice? I can't answer that. I can answer this. When I was a little kid, we didn't have any women on the Supreme Court. No one even thought about it. We never had a woman Secretary of State, much less a black woman vice president. So now we've had a black male president and a black woman vice president. His family comes from India and the Caribbean. That didn't happen when I was little, you guys. So yes, things are better now than when they were. But what about all the mean people? They've always been there. It's just that now they're extra special mean. And they're on TV more saying stupider, crazier things. Having said that, I told you that Nixon made Pearl Bailey the ambassador of love and said that Elvis Presley was cool because he was on prescription drugs. So if you think it was not crazier then, people would hijack planes and take them to Cuba for no reason. That happened a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Trump's an Uncle Bummer. There's no question of that. And he is his own civil war. And it was the worst thing that ever happened in 100 years, no question. But it was always happening. I just listed all the people that went to jail for doing Nixon's dirty deeds. And then there was Gerald Ford and Herbert Walker, who exonerated everyone. They've got a thing going. At the top of the show, I played Gil Scott-Heron. And because it's Juneteenth, let's hear one little thing here from... really? I had teed up Live and Let Die.
Wow.
At the top of the show, that one made me laugh. At the top of the show, we had played a little jam called It's Your World by Gil Scott-Heron. And he wrote a book, and it's called The Last Holiday. And Jennifer said it to me yesterday. People have been talking about Juneteenth all week and the meaning of it, the importance. Yesterday, that stirring ceremony where Opal Lee, the grandmother of that cause, who's been literally walking for years... her home in Galveston, where the original Juneteenth took place in 1865, was burnt to the ground by white supremacists in 1939. Her family didn't move. She's 95 years old. For the last 7-8 years, she's been walking everywhere, going around the country. Kamala Harris introduced a bill over a year ago to make Juneteenth a national holiday. In the face of all the racism this week and that critical race theory nonsense and the Governor Abbott of Texas feels bad because Texas history makes him sad because they fought the Alamo to keep slavery, which no one will ever tell you. It's never in any of the movies. I saw the John Wayne movie when I was little. I'm like, I'm a little confused. Mm-hmm. What does he say? John Wayne goes, it's a word called liberty.
Right, Mexico abolished slavery.
There was no slavery in Mexico. The Mexicans were coming into Texas. What the Texans were afraid of wasn't that they couldn't have their liberty. They were afraid that they couldn't have their slaves anymore. So they wrote it into the original constitution of their state. In any case, this is a book about going on, in part, Stevie Wonder calls Gil Scott-Heron, who's a poet, an educator, and a songwriter, and asks him to go on the tour to help make Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a national holiday, which it was finally in 1983. It became a holiday. Reagan signed it into law. Reagan, the one who said states' rights are Confederate rights, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, John Henton is a friend of mine from Cleveland, comedian, living single, what's his show? We knew each other in the old days, in the 80s. John Henton had the best Martin Luther King Day joke. This is one that was an issue. He goes, Arizona voted, right, the states had to ratify it, and Arizona didn't vote for it. So Arizona didn't have it for a while, you guys. January 19th, regular day. Move along, nothing to see here. His joke was, Arizona didn't vote for Martin Luther King Day. Man, you got to be racist to vote against a day off. Right? So we got Juneteenth today, and it's profound, because... in the face of all this nonsense, in the face of Ted Cruz and Governor Abbott saying critical race theory is some sort of seditious nonsense and is designed to make people feel America's racist, well, I've got news here. America is racist. The thing isn't to do hide your head in the sand and go, America's, oh my God, I wish it wasn't racist, or that's not who we are. Go, it is who we are, and look how much forward we've come. Look how the progress we're making. It's not unusual now to see black mayors of every major city, San Francisco, Atlanta, Chicago, you know. So here's Gil Scott-Heron's album. I want to show you gifts that people have given me, which that I hope we keep going with when the world starts again. I was given this at a gig, and it's called Winter in America. And he did it with Brian Jackson, his frequent collaborator. And it's got a song called The Bottle about alcoholism. I don't think that song's on here. There's a live one. I like the song We Almost Lost Detroit. Mm-hmm. But Gil Scott-Heron has a beautiful stentorian voice. And his father was the first black Scottish player to play... I mean, the first black player to play in the Scottish football leagues. Mm-hmm. So his whole family is astonishing. He's not here with us anymore. I brought this on just to show off. Years ago, I was in Edinburgh about 5-6 years ago doing a Whose Line show. And Nile Rodgers was there. And maybe this will key to who now Rogers. Ah, freak out. Le freak. C'est chic. He was the brains, him and Bernard Edwards, of Chic. He also wrote, by the way, Upside Down, Boy, You Turn Me. And he wrote, I'm coming up, I want the world to. And he wrote, We are family. I got all my sisters with. Oh, yeah. Nile Rodgers wrote all those and many, many more. But I asked him, I met him. And Clive Anderson gave me his copy of Nile's book because he was hosting the show. And he had underlined passages, which I can't find one, but it's hilarious. It's so Clive, he's a lawyer. He had underlined passages in the Nile Rodgers book that were going to be of salient interest to the radio crowd. So he gave me the book, and I said, thank you. And then I said to Nile Rodgers, my wife isn't here, but she's a huge fan. And he wrote, aw, freak out. he was so cool. And then, let's see here. Since it's Juneteenth, I wanted to share another thing. We were in Memphis a year or two ago, and it could be four times, at the Stax Museum, which is just, don't ever miss it if you go to Memphis. Whoa! And I won't break your record, I promise. I bought this album there by Isaac Hayes. It's called Black Moses. Why do you show it to us? This is why. Yeah. The chains. There's also an inner Moses one.
Careful.
That folds out. And two. An enormous... Black Moses.
Amazing.
It's the best album to own in the world. It's so, and it's a sensational album. It covers all the bases. It's soul, it's funk, it's slow jams, it's magnificent. His Cadillac is at the Stax Museum, and it's a gunmetal gray-yellow affair with leather upholstery, and it's on a turntable so that you can see it at all times. The doors are open. There's gold all over it. And there's a sticker next to it with Isaac Hayes' face, and it says, "Don't touch my ride." And at the Stax Museum, the seven or eight greatest artifacts I've ever seen in my life, Bobby Blue Bland's suede brown bootlets that he wore on stage when he played the blues. If your name is Blue Bland, it's almost assuredly that you play the blues. Rufus Thomas's fur boots. He's the one who did The Funky Chicken that includes the lyrics. Your arms start flapping and your feet start kicking. And that's when you know you're doing The Funky Chicken. Which is a sensational fucking number, by the way. World's Oldest Teenager, which now I am, of course. If you think being a teenager is hard when you're like 13 to 18, try it at 61. Fuck. I mean, when you go to homeroom, everyone's like, go away. Grandpa, if you have a chance to go to the Stax Museum, here's a book that I thought you'd enjoy because of its enormous graphic quality. Kwame Alexander and Kadir Nelson collaborated on this. It's called The Undefeated. What does it mean? It's just black history. But I wanted to show you the majesty of... I don't know them either, by the way. I'm just a fan. Kadir Nelson did that extraordinary New Yorker cover of George Floyd, and he tends to paint in the heroic. And I'm going to show you something if I can open the goddamn book to the page.
We saw his work at the Negro League Museum.
That's right. He had enormous paintings of the last year at the Negro League Museum. And, well, here's a picture of Jesse Owens jumping through the sky. Everyone's heroic, as I say. It talks about slavery and whatnot, and I think we have to, not forever and ever on this show, but it has to be acknowledged, and there's no way of getting around it. If you enslaved a group of people and brought them over and made them build the country, you have to admit it. Then you have to try to make things right, even if it takes forever. And that's the part where it feels like right now, like, oh, it's taking forever. And it will. It certainly won't be over in a minute. But think how grand and glorious the work is because of all the people that did it before you, like Opal Lee. Or all the people in the book, The Undefeated, there, where he goes through jazz stars and Ida B. Wells, who's very pertinent now. Speaking of heroes, I'm just going to brag now. I went to the Negro League Museum and hosted it. Sharon Robinson is Jackie Robinson's daughter. She's an educator. There she is. You can see her as a child. And she got up and spoke at the Negro League Museum. And all the stars were sitting there, Dave Stewart from the A's and whatnot, Dave Parker. And she said, I have a question for all of you. What are you doing for children? And each one of the ball players, Eric Davis, Fred McGriff, Dave Parker, and Dave Stewart, all had children's charities. So there are all those kind of people giving back to the community. And she wrote, with love. She's fantastic. How would you like it if your father was Jackie Robinson? How would you live up to that shit every day? Like, I think I have pressure on me because I got to go to the store and then get high. If your dad was Jackie Robinson.
She said when she was 13, she decided to be an activist.
Right? She's 13. But at her house, as she describes in that book, by the way, because this book, I wanted to hip it to you. It's called Stealing Home. But then there's another one called The Hero Next Door. And she talks about her life and growing up in upstate New York, or Connecticut, rather, and in a white community and with her brothers. And, you know, Martin Luther King would call. Ralph Abernathy would be there. Then they have a lawn party. Every celebrity in America was there, and every civil rights activist. Because Jackie Robinson embodied what, how do you describe it now? Naomi Osaka, what the Williams sisters, Billie Jean King, an activist athlete of the highest order. Bill Russell.
LeBron James.
All of the women in the WNBA. The women that play for our national team, Megan Rapinoe and all them. That fantastic call to action, and at once you're a celebrity. And Jackie had that. And imagine being the first black guy they let play. Baseball celebrates it, which makes me laugh so hard. Every year it's like, when we finally let a black person play, and look how well that turned out. Look, we got Willie Mays. You know, like, you guys, this should be hang your head in shame day for 1,000 years is what it should be. Instead of having a jet fly over, like, wow, you guys. Well, it turned out all right. We ended up getting C.C. Sabathia. So anyway, they take it with great good grace. What is this book that I'm looking? I'm trying to find one. Oh, our friend Bill, who's a good friend of the show, gave me this years ago. I just wanted to hold it up to you because it's Boss, and it's called Unbottom. Oh, this is her second book. Her first book's called, this is Shirley Chisholm, who was the first black congressperson, woman. And she, because women weren't allowed to hold office, black women, it's called The Good Fight. And this is her election campaign she ran against Nixon in 72, y'all. Her other book is called Unbought and Unbossed. And this is why I love Bill more than life itself. He got it at a used bookstore, but look who wrote it. Fucking Shirley Chisholm. So, there's a book here in Los Angeles called S.O. Wan Books. It's an African-American-based store run by black people. And Jennifer and I, during the containment, would order books from there and then go and pick them up because it was too dangerous to browse. But I'm assuming we're back to browsing soon. Black-owned businesses are one way you can support black people in the black community. Dear Greg, your show, blah, 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 very nice. Thank you for what you do best. Dave and Jasmine gave me this. It's called Tears We Cannot Stop by Michael Eric Dyson. You may remember Michael Eric Dyson from, he's on TV a lot. He's a reverend and also a political scientist.
James Fugate at S1 says they're still having a boom.
Oh, yeah. Well, there they are. They've done mad business this year, and they won an award, didn't they, for Best Black-Owned
Books? Publishers Weekly.
Yeah. So I congratulated him the other day, and he said, thanks, it's been a crazy year. Because of what happened last summer, and because of the police riots, the attention focused on inequality in this United States with Asian people, trans people, gay people, Latin people, Native American people, but particularly black people, their interest in all that history went through the roof. And I think they might have had their best year. And that's what's incredible about what happened in the last year. There are a bunch of positives. One, I'm going to wear a mask on a plane so I don't have to ever, ever show you how I really feel again. Two, okay, there's one positive. And anyway,
President Obama promoted their store.
I know. Obama promoted their store. Michael Eric Dyson was there reading from right a couple years ago when we were there. He was coming for a reading there. Oh, they get everybody at Essawan. It's on Issa Rae's show. It's on Insecure. It's a hipster place in LA, but you can order from there online is what I'm getting at if you can't get to Los Angeles. But I'm sure there's a Black-owned bookstore in your bailiwick and jazz like that. So what I'm getting at is this. The Nazis are always there, and they're always going to fight, and they're always going to be wicked, and they're always going to be evil. But we also have a voice. And if you hadn't noticed, things have kind of been going our way a little bit lately. When you're up against the ropes and you're screaming about critical race theory and Dr. Seuss and whatnot, and you really can't come up with anything, and then everyone gets a giant stimulus check and the governor of California gets in a roller coaster and offers you Coke and shit, I don't see your popularity going up that high. I mean, if all you've got is Ted Cruz whining at me, because I can... Ted Cruz always looks like someone who's passing something terribly unpleasant through his lower alimentary system. Ted Cruz is always... when he's your messenger, and when Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell are bringing the message, Yeah, there's plenty of hateful white people who are still going to go, yeah, this party's not over yet. Let's do another rail of meth and move to Wyoming. But then I think there's a lot of people who are on the bubble, kind of. You know, the people who float along. And I think they're like, I got a stimmy. This guy's not so bad. And then you have to ask yourself, do I want to put on a fur mankini and Viking horns and rent an Enterprise Ford Seditionist and drive to the Capitol to hang the vice president? Or is it too much trouble? And I think that's where a lot of people are coming down right now. What's happening is that people are being empowered. And I know you want everything to go faster and the Justice Department to work faster and all these things to work faster. But give it another year. I promised everybody that when everything changed in January, that it would be different 6 months from now, and it is. I can't promise everything is going to be good, but in another year, like, say, June next year, I think the world and the whole terrain is going to be different because we really will have a good deal of the COVID under control, I think, in another year. And here's the other thing. It'll always be with us and we'll always be different, and I'm willing to accept that because we're alive and we can still love and laugh and dance and feel and shit. I think, you know, any major trauma requires everybody coming together, and that's what I appreciate about you guys coming here tonight and letting me show you all my autographed books. What started out as a promising comedy show has ended as the Antique Roadshow, me showing you a collection of tomes that very few people have any interest in, and I really could be at my own particular section of the Smithsonian now, just standing there as a docent with a giant name tag on, the last guy wearing a mask 3 years from now. This section's entitled The Negro Leagues, A History. If you'll turn to the right, you'll see that Satchel... Come back, only customer. Yes. As the sun sets... Whoa, there we go. I just have... I don't mean to be a blind optimist, because I'm not. I'm too cynical to be a blind optimist. But, I also don't ever want to be just the relenting bummer. If you get Juneteenth in a week where they're literally trying to push that the seditionists were on vacation and that critical race theory is harmful to white people, and that week's the week you get Juneteenth, I think you get a win. I think you call that one a W. I think when you go from a few years ago, when Putin... when 45 was osculating his man bag with a fervency hitherto unknown, you have never seen such enthusiastic osculating of below the equator the way you have. And then to see Biden get up there and go like, ah. There's one thing you need to know about Russia, and that's that they have no economy. Mm-hmm. So when Biden says things like, you know, I want you to do this, I want you to do that, it's not a matter of I'm ordering you to do it. It's a matter of literally I'm going to pay you to stop interfering in the election. This is what international politics are. I don't want to bum anyone out. What gives me hope to carry on is that when you see a 95-year-old woman at the Juneteenth ceremony and Biden gets down on his knees and kisses her, symbols aren't lost on me. Waving a Bible around after you tear gas the crowd is one symbol. Getting on your knees to kiss a 95-year-old black woman is another symbol. And that's the one that I like to hold on to. You guys have been awesome. You've been the smartest crowd in the world. I've been the smartest man in the world. Maybe Paige, you turn be a Satchel Paige. Maybe Bell That Rings For You be a cool Papa Bell. And if you have to buy bonds, make sure they're Bobby Bonds. I'll see you next time. I love you. Thank you for coming out tonight. I'll be at the VIP in like 5 minutes.